Okay, bonjour à tout le monde. So today we have the pleasure to have the two lectures combined in just one slot by Andrea, and these are the two last lectures of the cycle he gave here. So it was a great pleasure to have him for the whole month. And the two lectures will deal with two different topics, but which are connected, as you will see. Oh, now they are called nonlinear phononics 1 and 2. Originally, they were called nonlinear phononics and light-induced superconductivity, which I guess will be there in the background anyhow. Okay, so Andrea, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much. Thanks for coming. So let's see. I wonder how many people have been at the previous lectures, but I'll repeat some of the things that I've said already, and these two lectures are designed to be at least internally consistent. So first statement is so the general area of research that we are exploring is one in this broad area of quantum or complex materials. These are materials that for various reasons, generally because some key ideas of classical condensed metaphysics fail in these materials, and the microscopic degrees of freedom become very tightly interdependent. One ends up with highly nonlinear systems that have very many states in which or phases that they can acquire, and in fact these materials are also they acquire all these interesting states, such as high temperature superconductors in some oxides of copper, various interesting responses to magnetic field, the so-called colossal magnetoresistance effect, and many, many other things. And the key theme is that these solids end up having functionalities that, one, are relevant for applications, and two, are extremely sensitive to all sorts of things. So, for example, if you walk through these phase diagrams, you can see that by changing temperature or by changing the exact alloying between different microscopic components of these materials, one has all these phases. And one would like to control these phases, which in these complex diagrams, in new ways, say. That's one way of thinking about this area of research. So there is in these systems, there is a very striking, like in many other physical systems, there's a very striking connection between the microscopic structure and the macroscopic properties, let's say the atomic structure of these materials, how the crystal is arranged. So here I showed one of my favorite plots that I've taken from one of Antoine's talks. I show you four oxide perovskite structures of oxides. So these are either vanadium-based oxides or titanium-based oxides. These are four materials in which only one unpaired d electron is found close to the Fermi level, and hence one in which the magnetic properties and the transport properties are determined by this single electron. And you can see how by changing effectively only one degree of freedom, one structural degree of freedom, one can go from a metal, in this case of strontium vanadate, in which this bond between vanadium, oxygen, and vanadium is straight, to a situation in which this bond between titanium, oxygen, titanium is crooked by, say, a few degrees. One can go from this metallic compound to a very interesting ferromagnetic correlated electron insulator. And in principle, what one would like to do is to have a means to control one single bond angle and be able to control this. In principle, one can apply pressure and one can grow different solids so that perhaps the pressure of other atoms can push and can control single coordinates. But maybe there's in principle you would really like to take one material as it's given to you and then move with your fingers your atoms in a certain direction. So One way to do this that we've been trying to study has been making use of mid-infrared and terahertz radiation. And by using mid-infrared and terahertz radiation, one can couple to long wavelength modes, vibrational modes of the solid, as long as these modes, again, have long enough wavelengths, and as long as these modes are odd, which means that they can couple to a light field. And so if one takes a system with n atoms, there's a number of these modes, and one can try to distort the lattice uniquely along one collective coordinate, which is given by the structure. Okay? So this is of course known. Every time you do a spectroscopy, an optical spectroscopy experiment with an infrared lamp, you will couple to these distortions and you will drive those modes. What's new about these experiments is that we want to design laser-based sources in which this particular, which we create either continuous beams or pulsed beams, in which the laser field or the electric field is very, very large compared to the field that is used to probe these systems. Okay, so what you can think of is really a force applied onto the system that, you know, let's say at zero temperature in which nothing is moving, and I apply a force to the atoms along one particular collective coordinate, and I can distort this to very large amplitudes. You know, I can easily, with laser technology, I can easily create, let's say, single wavelength fields with the field strength of, say, 10 megavolt per centimeters. So this is you know, a large number, and if the material is polarizable enough, at least if one extrapolates from the linear properties of the crystal, one can think of moving the crystal 10% of the atoms 10% of the unit cell, or even melt the solid along this coordinate. So that's what we call, that is the topic of today's lecture. How can I think of a crystal in its which is prepared at low temperatures, for example, in its ground state, and how can I think of this crystal as it's being deformed? As it's being deformed along one normal mode coordinate. Okay, so that's what we call nonlinear photonics. And the goal, having in mind what I told you before, that in some crystals I can change the properties by for example taking a single bond and making it from straight to crooked or vice versa. The goal is to take this material, which in the previous picture was yttrium titanate, say, and then make it more the way the strontium vanadate was with a bond. So, and I would like to, and I will sort of tell you, you know, in condensed matter physics textbooks, one thinks of these transitions and as happening infinitely slowly, especially, you know, so all the language that we have about phase transitions are about cooling this crystal down and biasing in a way when you get to a point where the transition between this symmetry and that symmetry happens infinitely slowly, and then we have a whole language that allows us to understand how these symmetry changes occur. But what we would like to do is to really study how I can cross these barriers at will with a light field. So this is sort of light-matter interaction with a goal of controlling the macroscopic properties of a solid at fast speeds. Let's see. Turns out that if you want to take a crystal and take it from this position to that position, a single light pulse of this type or a light pulse of this type is not enough. And the reason for this is that if you think about, say, the linear response of an infrared active mode, which, as I said, is a mode that has coordinates that are odd against inversion, and if I consider what happens to the atoms in this field, so this is, let's say, some collective coordinate, which I call Q, as a function of time, the way to discuss the motion of these atoms is by solving, in linear response, solving a damped harmonic oscillator equation, which takes atoms from this position and, after the pulse is gone, after some time, brings them back to the same position, because the area under a light pulse is exactly zero. So it's in what I showed you before, take the bonds that are crooked and make them straight, is not possible with a light field as such, at least if I think about the linear response. This is the same reason that a free electron doesn't absorb photons. Free electron is shaken by a photon, and then once the photon is gone, it's back to where it was before. They cannot communicate energy to it. However, and so this is you know, but however, there's the whole business of nonlinear phononics is that if you excite one mode, which we call infrared mode, this mode will couple in some ways to other modes. And in principle, if I do things right, it's possible to drive a change into the crystal that has a finite area, which means that I will not only take the atoms and bring them, you know, shake them around and bring them back to rest, but I will move them in one place and I will leave them there. So that's one of the goals of exploiting this coherent interaction between different modes so that I can do that. Okay? And the reason, okay, and the way to do this, so the protocol is excite one mode, make sure that this mode couples to a second mode in a way that this second mode, you know, if this is the time axis, the first mode shakes, but the second mode is being displaced on average. And I know that I can do this because I know that when I heat up materials, for example, and so when I heat up materials, all the modes start shaking, I not only do I have zero average motion, but I also have finite motions such as thermal expansion. Thermal expansion is an example of nonlinear coupling between modes in which a lot of shaking gives rise to a finite displacement. And thermal expansion comes from this term. So this is now, I am giving you the energy of a particular, so I'm plotting in this plot a two-dimensional surface, which is of the energy as a function of the coordinate of two coupled modes. This is going to be what we call QIR, which is the mode that I will drive. And this is a second mode, Q2. And if I think about the potential, the dependency of the potential, for example, on the IR coordinate, in linear response, what I had was simply the square coordinate. This is the equation of a harmonic oscillator. But then to lowest order, at least in a centrosymmetric crystal, I have this other term that couples the square of this odd mode to the other mode linearly. This is the term that gives me thermal expansion, as I will try to, in the case of acoustic modes, okay? So this is what I'm gonna try to, I'm gonna try to exploit at least this type of coupling to make it such that I can control the lattice structure coherently. So I wanna do thermal expansion, something equivalent to thermal expansion, but along one specific mode, which is being chosen and by driving the first mode surgically and specifically, okay? And the reason why, okay, so now, the reason why this can be very selective is that this particular term, which comes into the energy, is actually non-zero for only very specific pairs of modes. So I can choose mode number one, which is being excited, and I will have a finite response only for a very small number or a large number, but only a number of selected modes, okay? And this is, for example, one easy way to see this is that for this term to be non-zero, what I need is that the product, the product between this infrared mode, which is a vector, the square of this infrared mode, which is a vector, times this other mode, it needs to be a number. So there's actually selection rules of what I can couple to. Yes. It's true only for an A1G mode, only in a centrosymmetric medium in which the first mode is singly degenerate. When the system is not centrosymmetric, and when the modes are multiply degenerate, there's actually lots of things that I can couple lots of things, right? So the answer to your question is no, although yes, but let's say for the purposes of half of my talk, what you say is true. There will be a slide that says what you say, okay? Although this is not generally true. Okay, so let's think about the way I have to think about this. Let's see, so I come with a laser field. I'm repeating the things I've said over and over because I wanna make sure that you get the point here. I come with a laser field which is resonant with a mode which is red. And so now there is a harmonic oscillator which has its own eigenfrequency, and this is the driving laser field which couples through some proportionality constant to Q. And so I shake this mode, here's the pulse, and then the pulse goes, and this guy damps away on a time scale that depends on this damping time, okay? And so this, as I said, the atoms will oscillate about the equilibrium position, and they will never be left They will never move on average. Now, let's think now of the second equation. Remember, this is the coupling term. This is I'm solving two equations of motion for this mode and this mode based on this energy. The second equation will be that of a second mode in which the driving is not the laser, but it's the square of the first mode. This is because the energy had this, it was quadratic in Q, and then was dependent on Q square, the first one, and Q, and linearly on the second one. So the second equation of motion says that I have a driving force on the second mode, which is the square of the first one. And the square of the first mode has a direction. So the second mode will be driven either in this direction or in that direction, depending on the sign of B, which is a number that depends on how the two modes couple. Okay? So now all of a sudden I have a driving force, which is blue, for a second mode Q2. And so the second mode Q2 will experience, according to this very simple theory, some sort of mode selective pressure that will drive a displacement along this coordinate, which is finite, it's prompt, and under some circumstances will oscillate in time according to this eigenfrequency. Okay? Are there any questions? Yes. So in the case of a centrosymmetric medium, when I say odd, this would be the infrared active mode. And even will be a Raman mode. Okay?
So inversion.
Inversion, exactly. So this is, of course, this distance is, as I was answering before. I mean, this distinction is only valid in the case of a medium which has got inversion symmetry, in which things are either odd or not. Okay? But this is what's going to happen. Okay, so that's equivalent, and I'm just repeating over and over the same thing, to having two pendula, which are coupled through one particular functional form, in which if I shake one guy, on average, the second one is going to stay like so. Okay, that's the whole sort of lowest order nonlinear phononics. This is the equivalent of optical rectification in nonlinear optics. When I consider a specific nonlinearity in nonlinear optics, I know that if I have a second order nonlinear crystal, I can radiate a quasi DC field if I have an AC field that is coupled to the continuum through the second order nonlinearity. Okay, right. Okay, let's see. So I made a number of predictions. This lowest order nonlinear phononics should make use of an excitation with a red pulse, should displace the green coordinate, and this green coordinate should oscillate, and it should follow some selection rules. And I forgot exactly what else I predicted, but we're going to walk through this. So the first experiment where we showed this was in one of these complex manganites. So this is this lanthanum strontium manganeso 3, but it's at one specific doping, which is actually far away from any phase boundary. So just forget the fact that all this phase diagram is very complicated. I am taking a ferromagnetic metal, which is the phase of this lanthanum strontium manganite crystal, and I am exciting one of the phonons, as I will detail later, close to equilibrium. Okay, but I'm using this crystal because then we were going to walk close to a phase boundary, and we're going to try to look at how I can control phase changes. But in the next example, there's going to be no phase change. I start with a crystal that is a ferromagnetic metal, and I end up with a crystal that is a ferromagnetic metal. Nothing happens. There's just going to be some coherent dynamics. And the way we're going to do the experiment is the following. This is the way I do pump probe experiments. I have two pulses. One pulse triggers the dynamics in the system. And then I take a second pulse and I measure the reflectivity of the system as the dynamics is relaxing. Okay? So I come with a crystal. And in this cubic perovskite, which has generally the same shape as the one that I showed you in the first example, I'm going to drive this particular stretching mode that of the oxygen, I have six oxygen atoms around a manganese, six oxygen anions around a manganese cation, and I'm going to drive this mode backwards and forwards at its eigenfrequency, okay? And then I'm going to look with reflection how the reflectivity changes in time after I've excited this phonon in this crystal, okay? So if I do this experiment, what I find is that although I excite a very high frequency mode here, so this mode frequency is the period of this mode is not shown here, but is going to be a tenth of this shaking of my red diode, of my red laser here. So it's all started here and finished here. And then I look at long times and I see oscillations at a lower frequency that are indicative of the excitation of a second mode. Okay, this is a high frequency mode, this is a low frequency mode. So I see that I can change the reflectivity from one place to another, and I can drive these oscillations. If I also, these oscillations will depend in phase on whether the polarization of my probe field is like this or is like that. So this will show the symmetry of this second mode. And what I will see is that, so in more sort of specific symmetry terms, what I see is that if I excite this E1U symmetry mode, which is the IR, first IR mode, I can drive oscillations of an EG type of a second mode. Okay, so there's two modes that are coupling coherently. This is the first observation. I can drive, by exciting EU, I can drive EG oscillations of these torsional and torsions and bending. How do I know it's EG? Because it depends on the polarization. It's doubly degenerate depending on whether I measure the reflectivity along X or along Y. And the frequency is known by Raman. So I just look at the Raman tables and I know that that's EG. That's the second check, right? The second thing that I can tell you is that if I plot the amplitude of the second mode as a function of the wavelength of the first pump, what I can see is I can excite the second mode only if I am resonant with a line width of the first mode, which tells me that I'm not exciting the EG mode just by shining a laser on something, but I really need to excite the E1U mode in order to drive EG oscillations. Okay, so this is really direct coupling between mode 1 and mode 2. The third thing that I see is that the amplitude of these oscillations follows the square of the electric field of the first mode. Remember, what I told you was that the type of coupling that induced this effect was Q square in the first mode and Q in the second mode. And what I see is the excitation of the second mode at its eigenfrequency, so it's linear in that mode. And I see a dependency that is square on the coordinate of the first mode. So that's another prediction that I can validate here. And thirdly, the symmetry works because the square of E1U in this specific point group is contained in the EG. So the product of these two numbers gives me an energy. Okay. So the selection rules are right. So that's what's happening. This mid-IR pump excitation of the E1U mode drives the EG mode. The only thing I haven't shown you from all this data is that there is a displacement of the second mode. I've only shown you oscillations, but remember, but the key prediction is that I need to, on average, displace the crystal along the second direction. Okay, and this cannot be done by optics, at least cannot be done reliably, because optics cannot tell you exactly that all the crystal atoms are being moved from their original position. So the way we've done this experiment is to take these crystals and go to an X-ray free electron laser, which allows us to do X-ray diffraction measurements and look at the position of the atoms as a function of time. And when you do an X-ray diffraction experiment, what you will see is that a particular, if you're just exciting a mode about its equilibrium position, what you will see is that the intensity of a specific Bragg reflection will oscillate about its equilibrium position. But if the atoms are displaced on average, what you will find is that that particular peak, so the structure factor associated with that particular peak, will be displaced and will oscillate. Okay? And so this was the first experiments that we did there. So this is the experiment. You use an X-ray free electron laser, which is an accelerator. This is at the Stanford LINAC. This is an accelerator, which is 3 kilometers, and you can see under the highway here in Menlo Park, there's the accelerator, and it lases at say 10 kilo electron volts, And one can synchronize the mid-infrared laser here in the experimental hall to this accelerator and can do experiments in which one excites the phonon there, you know, within a meter, and then uses these X-rays produced through this X-ray free electron laser process and do a time-resolved experiment in this. Okay, this is an example of the output of the X-ray free electron laser. Okay, so this is actually pretty amazing that you can do this. But so the experiments have gotten a lot better now, but this was the first one we did. And you can make two predictions. You can say that if you're really exciting and displacing this EG mode, you can calculate, and this will tell you that this particular peak will go up and this particular peak will go down. We choose two peaks because if they both went down, peaks can also go down because of average heating, because of Debye-Waller effect. But peaks can only go up because of specific distortions that are not related to heating. And what we find is that although the data is noisy, we see a displacement that is of the right ratio for this peak to that peak corresponding to that motion. So at some level, we think we understand the nonlinear phononics in its lowest order incarnation. Okay, so broadly speaking, in the LSMO experiments, you can see that there's a displacive response, and this has been actually validated in other experiments much better. You get oscillations. This is resonant to the pump field, and it's quadratic in the pump field. Okay. So in this lowest order nonlinear phonon coupling, I can take a bond and make it straight on average. Let's see, and this is where I was here. Let's think about now, this is a bad picture, but let's take a different compound in a situation in which the doping is at the border between two phases. And let's try to drive a transition through this selective excitation. So what we take is a different material, and I apologize, this morning it looked like a much better picture, I downloaded it. This is, you know, a different compound. Instead of, this is praseodymium 0.3 calcium manganese O3. So it's somewhat similar to the one I've shown you. Some details are different, but at the 0.3 doping, one finds oneself at the border between two different types of insulators. One is a ferromagnetic insulating state, to the left of this 0.3 doping, and one is a charge-ordered, orbitally ordered insulating state, and here is some broadly defined insulator. So the system is always insulating if you don't do anything to it, and this has got to do with the fact this is a network, a cubic network of manganese 3+ and manganese 4+ sites in which I either have 3 or 4 electrons on each one of these cations, and depending on the details of how these bonds are, these electrons are either mobile or they're not, okay? But in this particular compound, the system is never metallic, except when I do things like, for example, apply pressure to it. This is an experiment that was done by Harold Wang in about 20 years ago, where he showed that if you apply pressure and you change the bonding angles in this compound, you could draw at already say 10 kilobars, you could draw transitions between insulating and metallic state. And this can also be done by applying magnetic field, by irradiating in various ways. And so in principle, what we wanted to do is an experiment where you can drive that specific bond and perhaps drive the insulator metal transition in a system that is never metallic at any temperature and at any doping. So this is the zero order observation, again, very early days. So the data, this is just measuring, you excite this particular mode, which now, as I will detail later, is a slightly different symmetry than the one I excited before. And you measure on the oscilloscope the conductivity as a function of time. So this is a log scale. You see a jump in conductivity by almost 6 orders of magnitude. And then you see some ringing at longer times that, for those of you that are experimentalists, you know, if the impedance of an oscilloscope changes in time, you're going to start having ringing. So just forget the fact that these oscillations have got to do with the fact that the impedance matching is only true at negative time delays and is not true at positive time delays. But here you can clearly see a change in conductivity by many orders of magnitude by exciting a phonon in an insulator with a 600 milliV gap, okay? And by only exciting this phonon. And so then, of course, this leads us to the question, what exactly is happening if I'm driving one of these B1U modes, and what exactly is this coupling to, and is the physics that I've highlighted with the lanthanum, in the lanthanum strontium case, the same that regulates this physics here? And so, this is again going back to one of the questions at the beginning, if you're in this singly degenerate case in a central symmetric medium, the excitation of this first mode, which is a BU mode, is only active if I'm coupling to a totally symmetric mode of A symmetry. Of course, there's many B modes and many A modes. And this was, although at the beginning we waved our hands a lot, we had a lot of help by Alaska Subedi, and who was working at the time at Polytechnique with Antoine. And he actually identified which specific B1U mode could couple strongly enough to which A distortion. And under those circumstances, he could use reasonable, you know, within a factor of a few, reasonable excitation amplitudes, and show by dynamic Amin field calculations that one could go in, actually in a related compound, which is the undoped parent compound, one would go from a large gap system to a metallic system. And so, although again, a lot of mechanistic details are perhaps to be understood, this gave us some degree of confidence that we understand broadly this nonlinear phonon excitation in this limit. Okay, so it turns out that we can achieve through basic nonlinear phononics this control of bond tilt in a way that allows us to switch between one state and another. Okay. Yes. No, actually, I'm not saying it's going to cubic. It's going in the direction of cubic.
Oh,
okay. The bonds are getting straighter.
Yeah.
And so, but all these things seem broadly consistent with one another. Okay, actually, maybe Alaska, you can help me in the paper here. This is not the cubic phase. This is it is the cubic phase. It is the cubic phase. The only experimental evidence that I have that the bond is getting straighter is by taking the data in LSMO and looking at the two diffraction peaks, and those indicate that in the other compound, by exciting a cousin of this mode, the bond is getting straighter. In this case, I can only tell you that the system is going metallic, I can only tell you I'm exciting mode A, and through calculations, I can tell you that we expect the bond to get the bond to be getting straighter and the system to go metallic. So,
and maybe two remarks on this.
Yeah.
First one, you couldn't drive it cubic because you can't change the symmetry.
No.
You can make it more cubic or less autonomic, but I don't think you can drive it to the cubic case, right? Correct me.
I don't think this is true, but maybe it is true. Yeah. I don't think this is true. I think if you drive it hard enough. I think you cannot reduce the symmetry in principle. If you drive the A mode hard enough, what's wrong with making it cubic?
Because moving around A mode doesn't change the symmetry.
But can it not raise the symmetry?
No. What will happen is that in plane direction, you reduce the more cubic. In the outer plane direction, you're sort of increasing the distortion.
But I mean, this is not a general statement. If you take a one-dimensional system with a doubled unit cell, you can excite an A mode that then pulls the bond straight.
No. Is that an A mode there? It's not an A mode, you know?
Of course it's an A mode. I mean, okay, it depends on the system, of course, but if you have a one-dimensional, this is an A mode in a system with a double unit cell after a Pyle's transition. So, okay, I'm happy to be wrong, but it, yeah.
But yeah. Of course, one doesn't need to drive the system cubic to make it metallic.
Yeah, okay.
And the third comment is that in principle, I suppose, that's for you to say, that the same experiment could be done also on the system, right?
The same X-ray experiment?
Yeah,
absolutely, provided one got beam time. Yeah, these X-ray experiments are extremely costly, extremely difficult, extremely competitive, so you only get one kick at one can. You kick it once, and then you cannot redo the experiment. Say, oh, we looked at LSMO, let's look at PCMO now. So they won't. You won't be. I mean, in a few years, we'll be able to look at these things more carefully.
Just to be sure, I understand this X-ray experiment. It captures the system after one picosecond.
Yeah, after at all time delays as a function of, and in principle, as I will show you later in a better way, in the YBCO. Yeah, you can, of course, and if you measure all the peaks, you can reconstruct the unit cell. And in principle you can sample the unit cell motions, provided that you measure enough peaks, with enough resolution, and it's just an issue of how much beam time you have, and
there's just one instrument in the world.
Right? Exactly. So we're getting, there's going to be a European free electron laser now in Hamburg. There's one going to be in.
No.
Soleil does different things. Soleil tells you about the average. Soleil tells you about the average structure. So these free electron lasers, they are pulsed, and they allow you to do dynamical experiments that third generation synchrotrons do not allow you to do. Yeah. So, but you know, the Hamburg machine is paid by everybody. These are so expensive, and so it's the one European machine where these experiments will be accessible.
You took your machine and you went to the slack to make the time resolve.
Yeah, exactly.
Do you think the time resolve so I can do as well? No.
No, I can't. No, there's various reasons. Number of photons, I know. Okay.
Okay.
Okay. Good. So at some level, this idea of driving A modes, as Alaska said, you can't change symmetries, and this is at some level not, you know, there might be more interesting things. So in the rest part of how long do I have now before the break?
Let's say 20 minutes.
Yeah. Good. I'm going to make two examples of more recent research where one can use these couplings. Study this was supposed to be A1G. It's a miss. It's written wrong. Where one can look at sort of more interesting type of distortions. Okay. I'm going to ask two questions. Can I use this lowest order nonlinear phononics to manipulate inversion symmetry? Again, this cannot be done in a crystal like a previous one. And can I manipulate time reversal symmetry? And I'll make two examples in which this is possible. Okay, so the first thing now, of course, the statement that we made that, for example, the B1U modes only coupled to the A modes are intrinsically related to the fact that the system has inversion symmetry to start with. If I take a system in which the inversion symmetry is broken, in principle, I can couple all sorts of pairs of modes. They could be both odds. Odd, for example. So let's take a simple ferroelectric. A ferroelectric is a system which in its ground state breaks inversion symmetry, and this is coupled to a electrical polarization. And of course, this is an example in which I could drive an odd mode to drive and to rectify another odd mode. Okay? So this is the idea. I want to take an auxiliary mode. In principle, when one tries to switch a ferroelectric, almost everybody that has been tried to switch ferroelectrics, they, for example, apply DC or quasi-DC fields, and they have tried to couple to this distortion of the ferroelectric, you know, and to switch it. In principle, so what we say is by the nonlinear phonon mechanism, we can take an auxiliary mode, which is at high frequency and is not related to the ferroelectric polarization, and exploit its coupling to the ferroelectric polarization for this to be displaced. Remember, because if I use a light field to drive this mode, all I will do at best will be to have something that switches between left and right. Whereas what I want, remember, is a force that drives me from position plus to position minus. So in principle, I can take what I said before, drive this mode, pump the auxiliary mode, and so there will be, as I mentioned before already, there will be a force on all the second modes that are coupled in Q square Q that follow the square of this mode, either a force up or down, depending on the details. And so this is exactly the same story as before, except that the second mode that I'm driving, where is this, will have, you know, a more complex surface than the modes that I told you about before. It will have this double well potential, etc. Okay? So in principle, what I can do is drive this auxiliary mode, which will apply a force on the other mode, on the other ferroelectric order, and drive ferroelectric order from 1 to minus 1, or from minus 1 to 1. This was actually clarified very well by Alaska Subedi in this paper on a different compound than the one I'm going to use, but I'm going to discuss experimental demonstration of these basic ideas. Okay, these basic ideas are that the square of the auxiliary mode will give a force that at low threshold, at low fluences, will simply displace a little bit the ferroelectric polarization close to its minimum, but above a certain threshold will allow me to switch. Okay, that's the prediction of this nonlinear phononics business. And again, if you take lithium niobate, what I want to do is to drive an infrared mode at this frequency and try to drive the polarization by coupling to this mode at lower frequency. Okay? And this is highlighted here. Right, okay, I'm repeating what I'm saying here. So I have this mode, which has got an AC, which is sinusoidally oscillating, and this will give me a force either on the whole crystal or in a small domain of the crystal in the opposite direction. So how can I measure that this effect is really what's happening? I can take a ferroelectric, and I want to have an observation. Like, of course, I could do an X-ray diffraction experiment, but I can also look at the ferroelectric polarization by looking at second harmonic. Okay. So the ferroelectric polarization, because this is now a probe pulse, a second pulse that comes in the visible, and because the system breaks inversion symmetry, one can have the generation of second harmonic through the nonlinear polarizability of the system, which comes from the fact that inversion symmetry is broken. Okay, so the measurement of the second harmonic will tell me that I'm in one of the two ferroelectric phases and not in the paraelectric phase. Okay, and so I can now do an experiment in which I start with the material, in this case lithium niobate, with a given polarization state. I pump the auxiliary mode with this mid-infrared field, and I come with a second optical pulse, and I will measure the second harmonic, which if I started with at 800 nanometers, will be a 400 nanometer wavelength. And I will have to do various other things to make sure that I'm isolating only the quadratic contributions that tell me about the polarization. Okay? And so this is what the experiments do. I start from, say, this plus P state. I come here, I pump the auxiliary mode here, and then I observe the second harmonic, which of course, because I start in the ferroelectric state, it can only reduce. So the second harmonic now goes down, and it goes exactly to zero. It bounces to a finite value, goes to zero again, and then it relaxes to zero. Okay. So what I'm telling you is that the second harmonic is going from a finite number to zero, finite, zero, finite. Okay. And so the problem here is that this measurement alone does not allow me to differentiate between the two following situations. In principle, this is compatible with a situation in which the first polarization state goes to zero, comes back, goes to zero, and comes back again for some reason. Or I could be going from red to blue, come back, so every time I cross zero, the polarization goes to zero, and then come back in the initial state. To be able to tell these two things apart, I not only have to measure the second harmonic, but I need to measure the modulus of the second harmonic and the phase of the second harmonic, okay? Because in this case, I will have a second harmonic which is pi out of phase with this. So this is actually something that my student, Roman Mankowski, came up with. What he said is that, okay, let's just take this lithium niobate crystal, pump it, and look at the second harmonic generated there, and then take an unpumped crystal and look at the second harmonic generated there, interfere them, and when I switch, when I induce switching in the first one, the relative phase will be encoded in the interference pattern between the two polarizations, okay? And so this is the result, this is the polarization, the interference between the two beams, it goes to zero, switches by pi, and he comes back again. So this is very, this is one of the first measurements, perhaps not the clearest, but you can clearly see that the phase of one of the two beams shifts by pi, okay? That's not what I wanted to show you. Yes, so this is what I showed you before. This is, you know, the polarization goes down, but then it switches to negative values, and this is encoded in the fact that the phase goes from zero to pi half. It stays there for some time, and the nature of this relaxation is actually not very clear to us, and then it switches back. The other interesting aspect of this theory is that this theory is very nice because it allows me to switch polarization from blue to red, but also from red to blue, because the force will act on this polarization by pushing it the other way, but it will also act on that polarization pushing it back. So in principle, if I take the crystal and I rotate it, I have to be able to show that I can switch polarization starting from either state. And this is what was done very clearly starting from either direction, I will have a force that pushes me from here to there or from here to there, okay? So I can rotate this by rotating the crystal. And what Roman was able to show is that if you start from the state where the polarization is minus, you can go at least transiently to zero and then go back. And then if you start from the state where the polarization is plus, you can go to minus and then back, Okay, so this is, you know, it's transient, and there's many reasons. I'm happy to take questions of why this switches back. There's at least two or three reasons why this might be switching back. But this is actually the first demonstration. Anybody that has tried to switch the ferroelectric polarization at most has been able to reduce the equilibrium ferroelectric polarization by less than 10%. Whereas in this case, by following this very nice proposal, we could use this auxiliary mode to drive the switching. Okay. That is example number two. And now I'm going to go to another example before the break, okay? And I'm happy to take questions at any time. So all I've told you up to now were all the excitations, all the nonlinear excitations in which I was coupling the square of one mode to link to the other mode, okay? If you take a textbook of nonlinear optics, of course, there's a million orders of nonlinear orders that I can exploit. Of course, one can think of, you know, this Q square coupling instead of Q square Q, which could give me many things like amplification, squeezing, various things. This is again a case in which I can have amplification. And this is what I'm going to focus on now, the situation in which I'm mixing two modes with a specific phase between the two. And I'll show you how this can be used to control time reversal invariance in a crystal. Okay? So that's. This is, I mean, all these things are being analyzed in various ways in our experiments. Today, I won't tell you about all of them. But this is another fast demonstration in which we showed that one can do this. So we look at a crystal of erbium ferrite. This is a crystal in which not only does, this is again in the general class of distorted perovskite crystals, but the important aspect here is that on each iron site, one has these magnetic moments, which are antiferromagnetically coupled in the planes. And because of a higher order type of magnetic coupling, which is called the Jelosinski-Maria interaction, one has a slight canting of the spins along the C-axis. So one has a finite ferromagnetic moment that points perpendicular to the planes. Okay? And what we decided to do was not to pump, was to pump these modes in the plane, but not to pump one, but to pump two. And so if you pump this mode and that mode, and you do this with a specific phase shift, what you can take, and you can have the atoms move either clockwise or counterclockwise or elliptically or linearly. And this is a way, of course, to break time reversal invariance, because if you propagate this forwards or backwards, for one particular rotation of the atoms, the result is going to be different. Okay? So this is, again, a magnetic insulator in which we drive these atoms in circle. What we find when specific excitation conditions are such that this excitation occurs in this circular way is that not only am I driving all sorts of modes in time, there's various oscillations that have got to do with different modes, vibrational modes that are being excited, but I also see this very clear oscillation, which is related to the excitation of a magnon, a magnetic mode that is only there when the atoms are going in circle. Okay, and the other thing that I see is that when the atoms are being made to circulate clockwise, the magnon rotates in one direction. When the atoms are being made to circulate counterclockwise, the magnetic mode rotates in the opposite direction. And when the modes are instead aligned, excited, so that the motion of the atoms is linear, there's no excitation of the magnon. This is, of course, just a demonstration experiment, but one in which it's clear that one can use this type of rotational excitations to break inversion symmetry in a new way. And so one could use this type, and so this new term in the Hamiltonian is something that mixes the two phonon coordinates with the sensitivity to the relative phase. Okay, and yes.
Can you recall what the probe was?
The probe is just reflectivity.
No. So this magnon
shows up as an oscillation of the reflectivity. Actually, this is not reflectivity. This is a birefringence measurement. It's the difference. Just one second. I'll come to you. It's the difference between. It's effectively a Kerr effect measurement. It tells me how this is rotating in time. Yes, please.
So this is possible only in the magnetic phase, no?
This is possible only in the magnetic phase, and the frequency of this vibration, of course, depends on what frequency you have at any given temperature.
So
Yes. But you're exciting this dynamically and you're giving it an additional kick. Yeah. But this is beyond the point. I mean, the issue is that this type of excitation can break inversion, can break time reversal symmetry in a crystal that doesn't have a breaking of time reversal symmetry. I mean, this is not unlike what is being done in the cold gases, where people make the atoms rotate in time. And yeah. So this actually concludes the first hour of summary of things that could be done with nonlinear phonons. And there's many things that I haven't told you about. And specifically, although I hadn't, you know, at some point the number of my slides was exploding, there's a lot of things that I haven't told you, such as, for example, nonlinear coupling between modes at interfaces, in the way I could grow two materials, or people that know how to do these things could grow two different materials that are in contact at the interface, and one could use phonons from one material to drive distortions in the second one and try to control the strain at interfaces. That's an area in which we're doing a lot of research. And also something that we'll just hint at, in some molecular crystals we'll show, for example, situations in which one can excite some phonons, and in this way modulate the electronic wave function on each one of the sites and change correlations, the correlation energies as a function of time. And again, something that is becoming more and more interesting now with time. We also have done experiments that I'm not going to show you, where one can drive one particular phonon in the system and use the quartic, the q to the fourth nonlinearities, to amplify fluctuations in this phonon in a parametric sense. And many, many other things that we're trying to establish. But this is, you know, this is an extremely flexible set of things that one can do with these nonlinear phonon excitations. And I'm going to leave you with that. And in the next hour, in about 10 minutes, I'm going to tell you about applications of this phonon excitation to superconductors. So, yes. Oh, yeah. Come again? Yes. Yes. So this is just a sort of a phenomenological. Exactly. So the way we rationalize this, although we don't know exactly, is that although the spin orbit coupling is effectively zero in the ground state, by exciting these rotations, what you can do is mix in higher excited states in which the spin orbit coupling is sizable. And so this is one way to rationalize why there's this particular form of spin lattice interaction, which is not the natural spin lattice coupling that one would have normally. So. But as, I mean, okay, we can discuss something more, but this might be interesting to some of the things that you work on. Yeah.
More questions?
Yes. When you write, say, time reversal symmetry, is this algebraic change or real time change?
I'm sorry, say that again? Oh, it's an average. Okay. Yes, good point. In this specific incarnation, provided that your field was on forever, then you would just, you would have a time reversal symmetry, depending how you do this, okay? Two things. Let's assume that you have two modes that have the same eigenfrequency, and now you're exciting them with a pi half phase change, then the atoms will start rotating and will keep rotating in time, and you will have a continuous breaking of time reversal symmetry from time zero to infinity. If the two atoms, however, have slightly different eigenfrequencies, what will happen is that the atoms will start rotating clockwise, then they will become linear, and then they will start rotating counterclockwise. So in principle, you could have also oscillations in time reversal symmetry breaking. I mean, it really depends on the protocol that you use to drive this. In this specific case, this is a specific case in which the two modes, in principle, after a given amount of time, would walk out of phase, one with respect to the other, and the time reversal symmetry would be broken in the opposite direction. But because of coupling and damping, what happens is that the atoms rotate clockwise at the beginning much more than they rotate counterclockwise at longer times. And this is because, but this depends on the specifics of the excitation that you make. Yeah.